This debate about Plato's theory of forms is the essential debate in all of Western philosophy. I can't back this claim up in a short lecture because I can't cover the whole of Western philosophy. But it does seem to me that beginning with Aristotle, who was Plato's student, he studied in Plato's academy for 20 years, going through the medieval period, the modern period, the contemporary period, there has been one basic question that has never been completely resolved and has never gone away. And it is precisely the one that we are discussing here. What is the status of universals? Are there universals? Is there anything in this world that really exists that is like the idea of beauty? Or, more like Thrasymachus and the Sophists, is there no such absolute, no such universal? Instead, there are only particulars. It seems to me that in the 20th century in particular, Thrasymachus's position was far more popular than Plato's. There were many, many philosophers in the 20th century who completely rejected any form of Platonism. Think of philosophers like Richard Rorty or Stanley Fish, or perhaps even the great Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. I would urge you to look at all these philosophers, and when you do, look at them with an eye to this particular question. It's a question that's sparked by reflections on the meaning of words. All of the philosophers I've mentioned, and Plato as well, begin with this question. What is language? What actually do words refer to? Language which we use every day, and therefore which seems so ordinary and commonplace in our lives, is actually quite mysterious. How is it that we can use these words, which are universal in their reference, and nonetheless only you interact with particulars? When I sit down at dinner, I sit down into a particular chair. Nowhere in my house will I find the form of the chair. Nonetheless, the word chair, as I've suggested, doesn't refer only to this particular chair. Of course it doesn't. It refers to every single chair in the world. The problem gets even more interesting when we come to words like beauty and goodness. Let me close this lecture by giving a quick summary of some of the really important points that we've discussed in the Republic. And I'm actually going to start with Book 2. What I would like to suggest to you is that the Republic has a beautiful structure to it. It has a momentum to it. And what we're finding out now that we're getting into Book 6 is that the dialogue is really picking up steam. We've broached the big issue of the theory of forms, and that's going to lead to even bigger issues very shortly. So let me just take a step back and remind you of how we got here. Let me begin in Book 2. Socrates says, for reasons that we've discussed, we must construct a city. Okay, so we do. That first city, the original city, is a city that meets only our most basic and minimal needs. Glaucon rejects that city. He says it's a city fit only for pigs. What we need in our city, says Glaucon, are relishes, luxuries, things human beings really want. And so Socrates moves forward. We move to a second city, which Socrates characterizes as feverish or luxurious. It's the city of expanding desires. It's the city where there's perfume and art and beautiful objects. The first city, if you reread it, you'll find out, doesn't even have furniture. The problem with expanding is that it will require the city to go to war. And the problem with war is that it requires us to identify a certain kind of citizen, a citizen who is well qualified to be a warrior. the main quality of the warrior is what Socrates calls spirit, aggressiveness, energy, the love of victory, using the word love very deliberately. Socrates said something in Book 2 which is chilling. I highlighted it then, and I wish to highlight it again. Once war comes on the scene, he says, I don't know if war is good or bad. And I think we are now in a position to better understand that remark. Because there's war, there must be warriors. Because there are warriors, there must be people with very strong desires, people with spirit. What's the dilemma faced by the city when it has such people in it? These are potentially very dangerous people, these people with spirit, precisely because their desires are so strong. What's the solution? Politically, education. These people must be taught to subordinate their own desires to the well-being of the city. Instead of being disruptors, they need to be guardians. And hence, we begin the process of education. It starts in Book 2, and it's really picking up steam now. This was the point of my digression, to take us back to Book 2, is to put what we're now discussing into context. The presence of these highly spirited, or to shift my term, erotic people, people like Polymarchus, people like Glaucon, poses a grave dilemma. But it also gives us a tremendous opportunity, gives Socrates a tremendous opportunity. An opportunity to do what? To discuss philosophy. Because it is the philosopher, as we have been discussing, who has a great love, a love of wisdom. And how is this love of wisdom expressed? It's expressed in this love of forms, of universals. This is the characteristic of the philosopher. So to return to the text that we had been discussing, remind yourself of the basic contrast. There are those people who are lovers of sights, of particulars. And then there are those people, and Socrates very much hopes that Glaucon in particular will be one of them, who love the universal. These are people who are able to redirect their eros, their love, their passions, away from the particulars towards the universal. And this will be the basic theme of the next couple of sections of Plato's Republic.
Lecture 11, Book 6, The Ship of State.
We're in Book 6 of Plato's Republic. Scholars sometimes refer to Book 6 and 7 as the philosophical books of the Republic. Unlike earlier books and later books, in which the issue of politics is paramount, or the issue of justice, the focus of Book 6 and 7, particularly the last chunk of Book 6 and all of Book 7, seems to be on the issue of philosophy itself. This is one reason why Plato's Republic is not just the first and perhaps the most influential work in the history of Western political philosophy, but indeed in Western philosophy in general. Let me offer you a couple of terms that have been used a few times in past lectures, but I'd like to make them explicit as a way of summarizing the philosophical background that we have traversed so far. The notion of form is basic. Let me suggest you also use the term being. The forms are universal, objective, absolute, they are changeless. Greek philosophy in general, starting with the early philosopher Parmenides, who had a great influence on Plato, identified this notion of the absolute, objective, changeless reality with the word being. So we might make that an equivalence. The forms are analogous to or even equivalent to being. Then there are those particular things that participate in the forms. And these are things that change. These are things that are expressed in the plural. You recall that the lovers of sights were people who were in love or enthralled by the particulars of the world. The particulars are fleeting. They are here today and gone tomorrow, as opposed to the forms, which are eternal, always there. The word that philosophers have used traditionally, another word that was used in early Greek philosophy to label this side of the world, is becoming. So the real issue for the philosopher is to somehow explain the relationship between being and becoming, between what doesn't change and what does change, between what is universal and objective and what is particularized. And of course, we know the outlines of how Plato does this. We broach this with the theory of forms, the notion of participation. Particulars participate in the forms. But we're not satisfied, to say the least. We want to know more. Glaucon, his main interlocutor right now, also wants to know much more from Socrates about these issues. But Socrates digresses. You're learning, I think, that the Republic is not a smooth and uniform logical argument. The Republic is a real conversation. And in a real conversation, we go here and there. We digress, we take a turn. We rarely, in a conversation between two or more people, just follow a purely logical thought. And in that sense, I would suggest that the Republic is a very faithful imitation of a real conversation. Because right now, we're going to turn away from the grand philosophical ideas of being and becoming, forms and particulars, and turn back to actual politics. We'll do so at least through a story that Socrates tells, a parable. The parable of the ship of state. It's found in your books, 488a to 489a. This is a very famous metaphor for the state, a ship. A ship has a pilot. The Greek word for pilot is gubernetes. It's the root of our word governor. The pilot steers the ship, is in charge of the ship. In Socrates' story, which is meant to illustrate the real world of actual politics, the city, the polis, is like a ship, and the ship is owned by a rather ignorant man who knows nothing of seamanship. Now, as a result of this, the sailors on the ship are left to their own devices, and they fight among themselves to see who will gain control of the rudder and therefore become the pilot of the ship. The sailor who wins this competition, the competition against other sailors, becomes the pilot. The real thrust of the parable is that that person who is good at winning the competition to gain the rudder of the ship and become the pilot knows nothing about seamanship. The true pilot, that's a phrase you'll find at 489A, the person who is genuinely knowledgeable about how to steer a ship is both unconcerned with the other sailors and the competition against the other sailors to win control of the ship, as well as pretty incompetent when it comes to that particular competition. this is for a very straightforward reason, especially if we try to put ourselves back in time and remember what it took to be a pilot in the ancient world, to navigate a ship. One of the key features was keeping your eyes on the stars, because in the absence of modern equipment, the only way to gain true direction is using the stars, finding the North Star, and the other great information that's given to the true pilot from the sky concerns weather. Is there a storm coming? Which way will the wind blow? These are the real ingredients of seamanship. So, in a really very beautiful visual image, I think, you can imagine the true pilot looking upwards to the sky, looking at the stars at night, looking at the clouds during the day. That's what's required to be a true pilot. But if his gaze is upwards, his gaze is precisely not horizontal, so he's not looking at the other sailors. The other sailors are looking at each other because what they want to do is gain control of the ship. So the difference, again, evoking this visual image, is between the truly knowledgeable person who looks upwards versus the politically competitive person who looks horizontal. Again, what this implies is that the true pilot is singularly ill-equipped to become the actual pilot. What this is suggesting is that Socrates seems to have a remarkably pessimistic view of actual politics, the real world. His point would be this, and let's focus on democracy for a moment as a regime type, because of course that was the regime Socrates lived in, Plato lived in, and that's the regime we live in. And I think it's on Plato's mind when he writes the Ship of State parable. In a democracy, whether it's ancient Greek democracy or contemporary American democracy, the qualification for being elected is what? To convince the people that you should be elected. So the qualification, the main qualification to become a ruler in a democracy, is to be good at getting elected. Whether a candidate is a Democrat or a Republican, an independent, is really irrelevant in this regard. All presidential candidates in our own country, all of the big-time politicians in ancient Athens, share one quality. They really want to get elected. Regardless of how often they say they're not interested in power, they only want to serve the state, which I'm sure many of them do, nonetheless, all of them must really want to get elected, because it's so hard to get elected. You have to devote all of your energy to gaining power. And therefore, this must be a prominent, if not overwhelming, desire in the heart of any serious politician. Again, translate what I just said into the terms available to us from the Ship of State parable. A candidate for president, I'm being anachronistic using contemporary American terms, but there would be an exact parallel in ancient Greece. A candidate for president is looking horizontally. His question, her question, is one and one only. How do I get elected? That's what they're good at. However, the true pilot is not looking at the other sailors. The true pilot has his gaze, has her gaze, upwards at the stars. And that's why they'll never get elected. This is, to reiterate, a terribly pessimistic view of the real world. And I think we can attribute this pessimism to Plato, although, as I'll suggest in a couple of minutes, he's a little bit ambiguous on this, but ultimately I believe he is rather pessimistic. He's pessimistic, to put the point in the terms again of the Ship of State, because the parable of the Ship of State implies that the ship will not get to where it's supposed to go. Why not? It's not being steered by a true pilot. Somebody is going to win control of the rudder, but that person hasn't done his homework. His homework would have been to study the stars, to study the weather patterns. But if he had devoted his energy to studying the stars and the weather patterns, he wouldn't have devoted his energy to gaining control of the ship. So there's a disconnect between genuine knowledge of how actually to steer the ship and gaining control of the ship. I would argue that the parable of the ship of state is one of the most pessimistic characterizations of politics ever written. Let's go a little further and explore Socratic pessimism a little more, because he becomes very explicit about it. Socrates describes, I'm going to quote from 489e, what he calls the necessity of the viciousness of the many. Fairly cumbersome phrase. What does he mean? Well, with this phrase, what he's referring to is a terrible kind of elitism, and that will be the focus of the next few minutes of discussion. Socrates is a monumental elitist. The line from 489e has just stated that he believes that the many, in Greek the word is the hoi polloi, a familiar phrase even in English, the majority of human beings are necessarily, that's an important word, necessarily bad. Well, that's not a view we're very comfortable with in our own country. That's also not a view that I think many Athenian Democrats would have been comfortable with either. Now, why are the many so necessarily vicious, inadequate, bad? Socrates gives two reasons. The first is that the many cannot, and I'll quote from 494a, accept or believe that the beautiful itself, rather than the many beautiful things, is. If you reread that line, you'll see, once again, the theory of forms is being evoked. The many, the majority of people, are unable to make this distinction between the form and the particulars that participate in the form. In fact, the many are terribly uninterested in forms. It's very easy to make this point. One only has to ask around, I think, in order to substantiate Socrates' position here. And here's what I mean. Let's imagine that there's a debate in politics about changing the tax policy. Taxes should be lowered, or should taxes be raised? And one party says it is just to cut taxes. Another party says it is just to raise taxes. There's a big debate going on. Well, I think most people, when they listen to this debate, are interested in one thing, which is tax policy in my country, tax policy that will affect me, in short, particulars. The particular tax policy of my particular country. Is that just or not? Is that a good policy or not? The Socratic thrust, the intellectual thrust of Socratic philosophy is to turn us away from particulars to the universal or the general by means of the famous what is it question. What is justice itself? What is the form of justice? I think Socrates' point is a very commonsensical one, and probably true. And that is that most people just aren't interested in this very general question. Can you imagine a televised debate between two major party candidates, and they're debating tax policy, and one turns to the other and says, excuse me, what do you think justice itself really is? I think this would be laughable. We don't hear this from our politicians now. Socrates didn't hear it from his politicians in Athens. The second reason that Socrates is so critical of the multitude, the many, the hoi polloi, is that they can't recognize a philosopher when they see one. This again emerges from the ship of state parable. The sailors are so busy competing for the rudder to gain control of the ship that they don't recognize that this strange person who's been standing in a corner looking upwards would actually be the person best qualified to steer the ship. Another reason that Socrates seems to be so pessimistic about the real world is that if there are potential philosophers in a city, they will no doubt be corrupted. So he has two reasons, two basic reasons to be so pessimistic. Number one, the majority of people can't be philosophers. That's his elitism. And number two, those who could be philosophers are usually tempted away from philosophy. They're corrupted by the city itself. Here, again, to be a little anachronistic, let's imagine a university. I teach undergraduates at a university, and I very often see extremely smart, energetic, passionate young people, intellectually ambitious. What happens to most of them? Well, they choose to go to law school, or they choose to go right into a corporation, or they choose to go into politics, or they choose to get an MBA and go into business at a very high level. This is a very understandable impulse on their part, needless to say. They want to participate in the real world, in the real city in which they live. Being a lawyer is the way to do this for many of them. And I mention lawyers because the Athenians had perfected the jury system as we even now recognize it. So being something like a lawyer was a very honorable task in ancient Athens, just as it is today. A very smart person will want to use his intelligence or her intelligence to make arguments, to analyze cases, to defend, to prosecute, to help the city make better laws. Therefore, says Socrates, again, he's very pessimistic, in actual cities, there are virtually no philosophers. And so what happens, 495D, human beings who are not real philosophers adopt the almost disguise of philosophers. For whatever reason, in ancient Athens, being a philosopher seemed to have some status to it in a very small sense. And so still, even in a city as hostile to philosophy as Athens, some people would still enjoy being called a philosopher. We might think of these as university professors of philosophy. They enjoy that lofty title. But according to Socrates, these are not real philosophers. The real philosopher, again, evoking the ship of state, is that weird person who is off to the side looking up to the heavens. A very, very telling description comes from 496D. This is Socrates' description of the true philosopher who lives in a real city like Athens. He says the following, and I quote, "This true philosopher minds his own business." You should perhaps remember that phrase from our definition of justice in our discussion of Book 4. "He minds his own business like a man who, in a storm, when dust and rain are blown about by the wind, stands aside under a little wall. Seeing others filled with lawlessness, he is content if somehow he himself can live his life here, pure of injustice." It's a wonderful image of somebody in a dust storm. Athens, of course, in the summer was very hot and dusty, who takes shelter by a wall. Well, normal politics is like a dust storm. The real world of actual political beings is like a dust storm. What the philosopher does under those circumstances is take shelter. In other words, lead a private life. That's what happens in actual cities, says Socrates. We can see now a way, I think, of conceiving the Republic as a whole. What is its major theme? I would suggest it's the integration of philosophy and politics. In actual cities, the philosopher must lead a private life, taking shelter under the wall. In Socrates' hypothetical city, the city he is constructing, the philosopher is the ruler. So what Socrates is doing through this very radical experiment of his own is trying to bring the philosopher into politics in exactly the way in which the philosopher isn't part of politics in the real world. The real world is like the ship in which the true pilot is ignored. The ideal city is one in which all those quarreling sailors stop fighting and say, hey, that guy over there has studied the stars. He knows how to get us home. Let's listen to him or to her, because the philosopher certainly can be a woman. The ship of state, combined with other things that Socrates says, suggests a kind of pessimism. At the same time, you might look at line 499D, and you will find Socrates saying, it's not impossible that it comes to pass. And by that, he means a philosopher becomes integrated in the city by becoming its ruler. So I'm suggesting there's a bit of ambiguity on this question. Does Plato believe that a philosopher really could rule? Does Plato believe that somehow philosophy and politics can become integrated? An open question. Let me make another suggestion to you. I would suggest that along with your reading of the Republic, you also read Plato's dialogue, which is titled The Apology of Socrates. In this dialogue, Plato imagines Socrates' defense speech. You recall from an earlier lecture, I discussed the historical Socrates. He was executed in 399 by the democracy. In the Apology of Socrates by Plato, he gives his apologia. That's the Greek word translated as apology. Don't get confused. It doesn't mean saying, I'm sorry. It means defense. Please recall that in reading Plato, we find Socrates as the hero of his dialogues. Socrates himself wrote nothing. We're always at a loss, therefore, to know with certainty whether Plato is accurately depicting the views of Socrates. So when it comes to the Apology of Socrates, should we think of this as the real words that Socrates delivered in 399? I would certainly imagine not. I think Plato is far too imaginative himself to simply provide a transcript of the trial, but I have no way of proving this. Perhaps Socrates did say these words. My strategy, if you recall from lecture one, is always when I use the word Socrates to refer to the character who appears in Plato's dialogues. And keeping that in mind, let's take a quick look at some major themes of the Apology, because they echo precisely the issues we've been talking about. The relationship, in other words, between the philosopher and the city. Socrates was accused of corrupting the youth and of disbelieving in the city's gods. Ancient Greeks were pantheists. They had many gods. Each city had its own special gods. The patron god of Athens was Athena. Socrates is a corruptive influence, and one reason why is because he seems to cast doubt on the religious orthodoxy of his time. Strangely enough, and I'll only offer this to you as a suggestion to guide you in your own reading of the Apology, I think Plato himself believes that the Athenians had a point, that there is a sense in which Socrates is a corrupting influence. And let me illustrate this point by means of an example. Imagine a young Athenian man who's been drafted into the army. The war against Sparta, perhaps, demands his services. And his leaders are telling him, you should join because this is a just war. What happens if this young man bumps into Socrates on his way to the draft office? He would tell Socrates, I'm going into the army. I'm going into the army because the war against Sparta is a just cause, and I want to fight for my city. If my life is lost, so be it. That's how much I respect my commanders, who, again, tell me this is a just cause. You can expect what Socrates would say. He would ask him, yes, but what is justice? Can you give me a universal definition of justice that covers all the particulars? Can you absolutely prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that this war against Sparta, in which you are prepared to lose your life, is a just war? If you can't tell me what justice is, how do you know this war is just? Perhaps it isn't. Well, let's imagine our young man being very impressed by Socrates' arguments. And he realizes, I don't know what justice is. Therefore, I don't know if this is a just war. I don't know if I should trust my leaders. They tell me the war is just, but they don't tell me what justice itself, the form of justice, really is. Well, what happens to this young man? This is a young man, by the way, who's like Glaucon, who's like Adamantus, who's like Polemarchus. These three young men who are surrounding Socrates in our conversation that we're having in the Republic. Our young man may decide, maybe I shouldn't go into the army. Maybe I should stay home. Maybe I should be a draft dodger. That's a very dangerous situation for the city. And that may be why the Athenians executed Socrates in 399. Plato was still a rather young man in the year 399. Undoubtedly, the execution of his inspiration, his philosophical inspiration, Socrates, made an amazing impression on him. And I would suggest that throughout the Republic, he's ruminating, he's reflecting on just this tension that obtains between a philosopher like Socrates, who, at first glance at least, might well be counted as subversive of the city's interests. And he's wondering, and in fact trying to develop a response to this execution, he's wondering whether there is a sense, an important sense, in which philosophy can be helpful to the city, in which philosophy and the city can come back together. His response is, there is a way, and that way is for philosophers to become kings and queens.
Lecture 12, Book 6, The Idea of the Good.
Perhaps you've noticed something in the last lecture. Socrates has a job ahead of him to explain what philosophy is, and in particular, to explain who these philosopher kings and queens really are. He has to explain, in other words, what it is they know. Something to do with forms, something to do with being. These are not lovers of sights, of particulars. They're lovers of universals. But this is hardly enough to be satisfied with. He seems, in other words, to be avoiding the question of the content of philosophy itself. In this lecture, we discuss the famous, or perhaps infamous, idea of the good. And you'll see, I think, why Socrates has been avoiding the question. We're nearing the end of Book 6 of the Republic, and it is very much the high point of the entire dialogue. Recall that the Republic has 10 books. The first is a prologue, which means that it's in the middle and end of Book 6 that we reach the center of the last 9 books. Another way to think about this stage of the Republic is to remember the opening lines of the dialogue. Socrates begins by saying, "I went down to the Piraeus." Many scholars believe that the entire Republic has a structure which begins down, low, works its way up, and then works its way back down. I think this is a very accurate picture of the Republic. It again implies that here at the end of Book 6 and at the beginning of Book 7, we're at the peak. What is the idea of the good? Socrates describes it as, at 505a, the greatest study. What in the world does this mean? He doesn't tell us directly. He gives us instead clues. For example, Socrates says, if someone does not have sufficient knowledge of the idea of the good, and a synonymous phrase, which I will use and Plato uses, is simply the good, nothing else will have value. No knowledge of the good, nothing else has value. I think I can illustrate his point by means of an example that Socrates is very fond of, and that makes a lot of sense today as well. Let's think of a couple of things that we all believe are good. For example, money. Money is good. If I offer you money, you'll probably smile and say, "Thank you very much." Socrates believes, however, that something like money is only apparently good, or to put it another way, is only potentially good. As a result, money is better described as being neutral rather than truly good. Now, why is that? Very simple reason. Money can be used badly. It can be used to buy terrible things. Money can make people very unhappy. No doubt you've read stories in the newspaper about people who win the lottery and have millions of dollars, and they find that their lives, which they had cultivated so carefully, are thoroughly disrupted by the presence of so much money. So people very often confuse themselves about money, thinking it's the best of all things, when I believe Socrates is quite right. It's not good. It's not bad. Don't misunderstand me. But it's not good just by itself. For it to become good, it must be used well. Rich people can use their money well. Think perhaps of the richest man in the world, Bill Gates. One of the many things he does with his money is support charitable institutions all over the world. It seems to me arguable that here's a very rich man who uses his money very well. How do we use money well? Socrates continues the thought. Only if we have knowledge of how to use it. And how do we gain that knowledge? For that, we need knowledge of the good. Knowledge of the good can guide our use of what otherwise would be only potentially good things like money. This point can be extended to all sorts of apparent goods, such as health, such as physical strength. If I'm very strong, I can do a lot of things with my strength. I can punch innocent people in the nose and hurt them, or I can use my strength to build houses for the poor. Either one, I need something to guide my use of the apparent good strength. Or, to give an example that we discussed at some length in an earlier lecture, what about life itself? It certainly seems that life is good. Who would disagree? Socrates would disagree. Life is neither good nor bad just by itself. A good life is good, and a bad life is bad. We must know how to use our life in order to make it truly good. And for that, we need knowledge of the good. This thing we're calling the good is the ultimate object of the philosophical quest. It's the subject, the study, which the philosopher ruler has mastered. We still don't know enough, do we, about what the good is, or the idea of the good. Socrates continues his somewhat indirect path. He suggests at 505b that most people think they know what the good is. They believe it is pleasure. Pleasure. Now, we know from the previous lecture that Socrates does not hold the majority, the hoi polloi, in high regard. And this is another instance of that view. Because, in fact, he believes the majority of people are wrong in saying that pleasure is the highest good. Although, let's recognize the fact that it's a pretty reasonable candidate for being the good. The great English philosopher John Stuart Mill certainly believed that pleasure in some sense was the highest good. Many such philosophers have held this view. The official name of this view is hedonism, which is the equivalence of pleasure and the good. It's a very reasonable candidate for the good because, in fact, if we examine our own motives, examine our own lives, of course, we'll find that much of what we do is motivated by just this desire, the desire for pleasure. Socrates, of course, this is his specialty. He refutes hedonism. He refutes this view. And he does so very economically, with only a couple of sentences. He says, for example, isn't it true, I'm paraphrasing, that there are good pleasures and bad pleasures? What if someone gets their pleasure from rolling around in the mud? What if they get their pleasure from just drinking lots and lots and lots of beer? What if they get their pleasure from doing violent acts against innocent people? Would we seriously consider these kinds of people to be good? Socrates appeals to an intuition here and expects the answer, no, of course not. Some pleasures are good, but other pleasures, rolling in the mud, acts of violence, they're not so good. That one admission that some pleasures are good, other pleasures are not so good, is sufficient in Socrates' mind to refute hedonism. Because what is being implied is that there must be a standard other than pleasure that measures pleasures. If pleasure X is good and pleasure Y is bad, they're both being measured by something other than themselves. And what is that measure? The good. And it's not pleasure. Therefore, Socrates believes hedonism has been refuted. How else does he describe the idea of the good? It is psychologically ultimate. What I mean by that rather complicated phrase is that the good is finally what all human beings really desire. Socrates makes a rather interesting observation. When it comes to the good, people want the real thing. No one is satisfied, he says at 505D, with what seems to be good, with what is opined to be good. When it comes to lots of things, we rest content with just seeming to have them. For example, many people are very eager to appear younger. Many older people are eager to appear younger. So they might engage in various surgeries or strategies to look younger. And they're content with that. I look younger, I'm not younger, but I look younger, and that's what I want. But when it comes to the good, to what we think or even know is good, appearance is just not satisfying. We want the real thing. Socrates also says the following: no one will ever understand what is just or what is beautiful if they don't understand the idea of the good. That notion comes from 506a. That's a very important point, because what has just happened is we've witnessed the idea of justice being demoted. The idea of the good is superior even to the idea of justice. To put this in another form, we're going to discover that the idea of the good, or the form of the good — remember, those two words are synonymous, idea and form — the idea of the good is the idea of ideas. It's the ultimate form or idea. Well, yet again, you've probably noticed that Socrates seems to be running what could almost be described as a public relations campaign for the idea of the good, telling us all these wonderful things about it without yet telling us what it is. Glaucon, who, as I hope you're coming to discover, is far and away the most important character other than Socrates in Plato's Republic, Glaucon is getting frustrated. And around 506d, he expresses his frustration and he says to Socrates, "Quit messing around, get down to it, and tell me what the idea of the good is." And then Socrates does something which is classic Socrates. When you've read many Platonic dialogues that feature Socrates, you'll know this side of him pretty well. He can drive you crazy. He doesn't directly tell Glaucon what the idea of the good is. Instead, he says, in a peculiar metaphor of his own, he's going to describe what he calls a child of the good, 506e. A child of the good. What in the world does he mean? To explain, he says, let's divide all of reality into two regions. There is the visible region. This earlier we described as the region or realm of becoming. This is where we find particular things that we can see with our eyes or touch with our hands, sensible things, things that have matter, things that have a finite lifespan. They are not permanent. This constitutes one region. The second region is what Socrates calls the intelligible region, referring to 507b. This is where we find the forms. They can be intellected with the mind, but not seen with the eyes. Equipped with this distinction, Socrates will offer us not a direct description of what the good is, but an analogy, or almost a proportional relationship. He asks us, how is it that we see visible things when we are operating in the region of the visible? Well, we see visible things because there's light. And what is the cause of light? The sun. The sun. The sun is not only responsible for visible things becoming visible, the sun is responsible for life itself. It's responsible for the existence of plants and animals and so many beings that exist in the realm of the visible. The idea of the good is related to the intelligible as the sun is related to the visible. That is the analogy. An analogy, in its most literal sense, is a relationship of four terms. A is to B as C is to D. As the sun is to the visible, so the good is to the intelligible. What the good provides is the truth. The truth is analogous to light. The idea of the good, Socrates says at 508e, is the cause of knowledge and truth. Just as the sun is responsible for the visibility of visible things, so is the good responsible for the possibility of truth. But also remember this, the sun is not only responsible for visibility, it's responsible for existence, especially of living things, living visible things. If we push the analogy, we find that the good is responsible for the truth, and the good is responsible for being, analogous to the existence of visible things. Then Socrates says something that we're now up to 2,400 years, people are still debating. One of the most famous lines in the history of Western philosophy, I'm referring to 508b. He says, the good isn't being, but is still beyond being. This is very cryptic, to put it mildly. Again, and I mean this very literally, people have been debating these few paragraphs in Plato's Republic for thousands of years, so I can't hope to decipher them for you. But let me help as much as I can by going back to the analogy between the sun and the good. The sun is responsible for the visibility and the existence of things in the visible world. Analogously, the good is responsible for the truth and for being. But there's a feature of the sun that we all know very well, and that is it's impossible to look directly at the sun. If you try it, and please don't, you will burn your eyes. Of course, you can wear protective shields or look through some kind of filtered telescope. Socrates is thinking about this, and of course, he's thinking about the naked eye. The naked eye can do only two things. Get the briefest glimpse of the sun and become aware of the sun in its reflections and its illuminations. If you're outside and you see shadows of trees, you know the sun is up there casting those shadows. If you're outside and you feel the warmth on your skin, you know the sun is up there. You could then take a really quick glance and you'll sort of see it, but you'll never quite see it, not with the naked eye. I think this is a very important point of the analogy. The idea of the good, if the analogy is going to hold true, can't be seen. It can only be aware of. It can only be felt. It can only be seen through its illuminations and its reflections. So the idea of the good is somehow inaccessible. And I think here we have an explanation of Socrates' reticence about the idea of the good. I think deep down, he is pessimistic about a complete explanation concerning the idea of the good. It's the ultimate cause of all reality and truth. He knows it's there, just as we know the sun is there when we feel its warmth and see its reflections. But he can't quite articulate it. Let me summarize what are now three basic features of the idea of the good. I'll use two words which I have already explained to you, ontological and epistemological. The good is of fundamental ontological significance.